Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. On Wednesday, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt announced an autumn statement which felt, for all the world, like a starting gun in the countdown to a general election, which has to be held by about this time next year. It included a cut in national insurance contributions, kept the triple lock in place, and featured a raft of business investment measures. I'm Damien Fantato, Deputy Editor at FT Advisor. And with me to pick through this week's announcements are Ian Cook, Chartered Financial Planner at Quilter Cheviot, Claire Trott, Director at Technical Connection, and Matt Todd, Associate Director at RSM. Hello, everyone. So leading the headlines in the immediate aftermath of the autumn statement was the cut in national insurance contributions. Matt, what do you make of this?
So we've got cuts on the self-employed and the employee side. So the self-employed, we're getting an abolishment of Class 2 national insurance, which was about just less than £4 a week. That was going to be cut, I think, about 5 years ago, and they ended up going back on it. So I think that's a bit of an easement for self-employed individuals. And then they cut in the Class 4 rate, which is the rate on profits, from 9% to 8%. Obviously, that's helpful. It's a boost for the self-employed. The equivalent cuts for employees in the Class 1 national insurance rate is from 12% to 10%. So for someone that earns over £50,000, that's a £750 saving a year. So, you know, that is definitely incentivizing to work. I think it's what it says on the tin.
Ian, as a financial planner, what's your reaction to the this cut in NICs?
I think initially my first thoughts were it was a welcome cut, but I think when you delve a little bit deeper into beyond the headlines and behind the storylines that will likely be in the press tomorrow, it feels like a little bit of political posturing, perhaps on behalf of the Conservatives. Currently, what looks like in the polls, they're losing a general election race, that it feels like today was perhaps the start of positioning for a manifesto. And really, in terms of when you consider fiscal drag and the fact that there's been no changes to any of the tax thresholds, that really is the thing that's been hurting people over an extended period of time. Whilst very much welcoming the changes, I do feel that it isn't going to make a huge amount of difference to those that have seen their gas and electric bills triple over the last 12, 24 months. So in real terms, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference, but a very welcome change all the same.
Mm-hmm. Claire, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we should always welcome a cut. I think for me, this was the easy option. Doing something with income tax is much harder, and there's ways to sort of counteract different things. So we should be grateful. But actually, I would have expected there to be something more for employers as well, especially as we've seen the increase in the national minimum wage. So the cost to employers for employing people is going to go up, and they're going to see that cost obviously expedited by the being, you know, not having any reduction in national insurance themselves. So individuals are going to be a winner. Just like Ian said, I think this is positioning for an election rather than necessarily a real true cut and a drive. But yeah, as we said, we'll always take a tax cut, however we see it.
Mm-hmm. Matt, in the before the autumn statement, we were saying that there was a lot of the rumours were initially focused around inheritance tax. That doesn't seem to have been touched. Then it moved on to income tax. That doesn't seem to have been touched. And now they've settled on this cut to national insurance. What do you make of this shift over the weeks leading up to the autumn statement?
So inheritance tax was apparently the tax to be cut in this statement. And I think we heard that in the press for months, not weeks, before the statement. But most recently, I think it came out that the rumour was a cut to the rate of inheritance tax rather than a sort of abolishment, full stop. And I think that fell flat politically, because if you oppose inheritance tax, you don't care what rate it is, if it's 40% or 30%. So I think that sort of took them back to the drawing board probably at the last hour. And then sort of over the last maybe 48 hours, we heard about the national insurance contributions cut, and then we've got the news today. I guess national insurance contributions rather than income tax meant that, you know, Jeremy Hunt could stick true to his desires and his principles of, you know, getting people to work, whereas income tax could have been viewed as a cut for sort of people with passive income investors, landlords, etc.
Mm-hmm. And Ian, from your perspective, is the there were lots of there were several tax cuts which were floated, as I mentioned. How do you feel about where we ended up? Would you have rather seen inheritance tax or income tax cut? And what do you make of the fact that they might have opted not to touch the first two and gone for Nixon instead?
I think very good question. On the position of inheritance tax, I've always been of a view, although it doesn't touch much of the population, it, as the polls have shown, it's a very emotive subject, with many people feeling like their hard-earned cash or their estate is going to pass through that threshold. But I've always been of a view that it's, in some ways, it's a middle earners tax, because generally clients or individuals or institutions with significant amounts of cash can afford to pay advisors to essentially mitigate their inheritance tax liability. So in some ways there's a bit of a moot point, and I can see why they've decided not to actually make a change to that particular area. In the area of income tax, I think, as Claire alluded to earlier, it would be much more poignant and much more beneficial to working individuals to have seen a cut in the rate of income tax. I'd also be interested, picking up on Claire's point about national insurance. Obviously, wage inflation over a period has been escalating, and I just wonder have they balanced the books in terms of additional national insurance take from the employer side to supplement what is no longer going to be paid by the employees, so the reduction. I just wonder if there's just a bit of political accountancy happening inside the books there. But again, without seeing the data, it would be very, very hard to comment. But always, a cut to income tax would have been preferential, for sure.
Mm. Do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree that, and I think the cuts to income tax are much harder to bring in quickly, and they wanted to do something so that people could see it now. We've seen changes in national insurance mid-year. If we take last year, we're flitting between the different rates that and employers have probably got systems now. They know it's going to change, so it's not all hard-coded. So it's relatively easy for someone to change something at short notice. Income tax, we know when we've had the changes in income tax rates, there's always a knock-on effect to the next level and the next level. I would have really have liked to seen an increase in the personal allowance, but we know that because of the changes that they made in March, with bringing down the 45% tax band to the top of the 60% tax band, then if you increase the personal allowance, then you've got the issue of the 60% tax band, so you'd have to change all of them in essence to make it work. Otherwise you end up with these weird numbers. So I can see why they've gone down the NI route. I'm not surprised about the IHT. I think it was leaked to see how everyone felt about it. And it wasn't getting the same traction that they probably hope it would get. And they probably thought, actually, we can get a bigger bang for our buck by doing something different. Mm-hmm. And we know it's a hated tax, I think, as Ian said, but it's not something that is really impacting as many people when it actually happens than they think it's going to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Conservatives are often looked at, you know, with IHT. So a cut in that would probably reflect relatively negative on them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as you alluded to, the next cut is being expedited to January rather than April, which is one of the factors which have made a few commentators suggest that we're going to get an election in spring. Matt, what do you think about what the points that Claire just made? What's your reaction?
So, I'm a little bit. I think, you know, the inheritance tax, I think it did fall flat politically. I think stamp duty land tax was also mentioned. I think that sort of falls flat politically, because how often does the average person pay stamp duty land tax? Mm-hmm. Not very often. I think, although Jeremy Hunt didn't mention it in his speech, there has been some ISA reforms and there's some finer details come out about that now. And that's going to be more important given we've got the ongoing fiscal drag and the sort of reduction in tax allowances, like the dividend allowance, on the horizon. So they could be somewhere to watch going forward. I think the additional flexibility around picking ISAs could be really helpful to individuals in making sure they mitigate sort of the stealth tax from frozen bands and allowances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just to stay with you, Matt, you mentioned you and Ian have both mentioned fiscal drag, and you've mentioned some of the changes to the dividend allowance. Jeremy Hunt was making a big show about the fact that how he was a tax cutting chancellor. How do you see people as being in a particularly in a much better position after the 6th of January when this next cut will come in as to how they were before?
I don't suppose so. I mean, Ian mentioned sort of energy bills and, you know, the next cut for an individual, so someone that's earning up to the higher rates of the full National Insurance main rate band, the maximum cut for employees is £754 a year. And for the self-employed, it's half of that, but then they also stop paying class two. So we're talking about a few hundred pounds a person, which obviously if you're earning over the 50K, then you definitely take it. But it's not really touching the sides. And I think this fiscal dragon, the stealth tax, if you have got a pay rise and you're now you're a higher rate or additional rate taxpayer, any further pay rise you get, you're going to be paying the highest rates of tax. And the NICS rate has only changed the main band, so that's not touching the top. You know, you're paying a higher burden of tax now overall.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the self-employed there. Obviously, he announced, let me just remind me, he abolished it, didn't he?
Abolished the class two.
Abolished the class three, that's right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the self-employed there, and he abolished class two NICS for them. Is that how sort of transformational is that likely to be for someone who's self-employed, if at all?
Not particularly. I think class two was helpful to sort of the lower earning self-employed people because they could pay it voluntarily and get the state pension credit, the national insurance credit. But, you know, at less than £4 a week, it was a few hundred pounds a year, you know, just a bit more than £200 to £300 a year in tax. So again, it's if you've got a self-employed person that's earning the big bucks, more than 50k or more than 100k, they're paying the 60% marginal rate plus NICs. It's not really transformative.
Sure. Ian, I don't know how many of your clients are self-employed. Do you agree with that?
I would tend to agree. I think anything that simplifies tax or contributions for tax is welcome. So many of our self-employed clients, typically they will deal with these matters through their accountant. So it's not necessarily something that we would touch or even a conversation that one might have. So for me, the change is limited in how I'm going to structure and plan what I'm doing with clients. So I just wanted to touch on one of Matt's points as well regarding allowances or indirectly regarding allowances, which is, we're having now with the reduction in capital gains tax allowance, we're changing the way in which we plan for clients. Whereas, you know, typically before we were putting monies into, say, general investment accounts to feed ISAs over a number of years, with the fact that the capital gains tax rate has been changed from over £12,000 to six down to three, and then the dividend allowance also being cut, we're now having to be more creative in the ways that we look after and manage clients' money. And again, what that does is we then end up moving monies into more tax efficient vehicles for the client. So it has a net effect of probably reducing taxation that's coming into the state as a result, because we're reticent to use those type of accounts where you may have said to a client, well, actually, look, deposit the money in this account, we can make £12,000 in gains per year, and you're just going to pay either 10 or 20% tax on the amount above that we make. Those clients now are encouraged to look at other vehicles. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, side note there, as opposed to directly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Claire, one of the other perhaps flashier, if that's the right word, announcements, at least as pertains to our sector, was the announcement of a pot for life. Effectively, it gives people the right to stay, to ask a new employer to pay and contributions into their existing pension pot. What's your reaction to that?
I think it depends on who you're viewing it as. So I think, you know, as an individual, then you think that actually that's, you know, really good. You know, I can make sure all my money's in one place. I don't have to do transfers. I can understand where it is, and I'll always just have one piece of paper to fill in when I move house. That sounds like a really good idea. The practicalities of it might be very different. And again, we're back to that cost to employers. Employers, in some cases, for their executives, will pay to another pension scheme, but it's generally quite hard work to make sure that they're doing it correctly through payroll and they pay the right amount to the right people in the right month. And you know, we've just gotten to the point that we're happily settled in the world of auto-enrolment. And for it's relatively easy to move those new schemes. I would say it's always difficult and much harder to move an old scheme, because there's a lot more complexities that we know that you should get advice. But the new schemes that are pretty bland post-2006, moving them between one another, not difficult. So Potfollows member could have been an actually much easier thing to do, rather than causing the cost and the issues to the employer to then have to pay the money across. There was a side note on that that says, and continue to look at bringing that in with CDC. There's still a lot of comments in there about CDC and promoting CDC. And I think there hasn't been the uptake in that the government probably thought there was going to be. And I think this might be another drive towards that. But it's just a call for evidence. It's a call for evidence that's going to take a long time to go through the motions. As we talked about the government, we talked about the election. I can't see any chance of anything like this being put in place any time before the election. I know they like to push things through, but this would be something that really, really needs to be thought through. Otherwise, we could end up with money flying around all over the place, costs to even the individuals if they end up in a pension scheme that's charged completely differently to what their auto-enrolment scheme is, but with no additional benefits, then what's necessarily the point? How are we going to be able to do that value for money for clients if they're not actively seeking advice, not actively speaking to the people and getting the right information? I know lots of people that just, they're in the default fund, they've never thought about it, and some of them have been in the default fund for 20 years. So how is that going to work with these people? They might just go, oh yeah, just keep sticking it in there. And their lives change, the scheme changes, the charges change, the fund itself changes. And they just think, well, actually it's okay because the government has suggested that that's the right thing for me to do. Mm-hmm. I think we really need to actively encourage people to take responsibility for what they're doing, where they're paying in. And at least with AE, we've got the employer's responsibility to make sure that it's a decent scheme, the charges are kept below a certain level, and their default fund is suitable for their client base as such, their members. So it's going to take a lot of work. It could work, but I think it'll be hard work, and again, a cost to the employers, which seems to be a bit of a theme that we seem to be talking about today.
Yeah, indeed. It seems the general consensus is that this is an awesome statement, which was all talk and no walk, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. Matt, what's your...
Can I just add to Claire's point?
Please
to
do.
Claire's point there, because I think, Claire, you made some excellent points there. And personally, my view would be, I would be concerned about range of investment options that may be available. Auto-enrolment's been a success largely due to employee apathy, thinking, I'm just going to contribute because I'm auto-enrolled, and actually I'm just going to forget to send the cancellation letter. But moreover, I think if anything over the last 24 months has taught us that there's clients or individuals that have been auto-enrolled into schemes that have automatically lifestyled. So those individuals that have gone into the default fund, they have not engaged with the scheme, are now in funds that are potentially significantly lower than they were at the start of 2022, because those funds have automatically defaulted and purchased government corporate bonds over that period for the safe option for the purchase of an annuity. I would have liked to have seen some reform in the form of engagement, getting employees to engage better, workplace enrollment programs and education programs. That's where I see the value. One pot, I can understand why the government have launched it, but I'm quite strong on engagement, having, been party to picking up the pieces of where people have just trusted the employer or trusted the government, ended up in the default fund and been lifestyled out. you know, those individuals have been left to potentially accept a lower income in retirement or work for more years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, it seems like the consensus is that this is an autumn statement, which was a lot of talk and not a huge amount of walk. Matt, would you agree with that? What's your takeaway? What's your overall takeaway from this autumn statement?
I think I'd totally agree with that. So a lot of talk and not a lot of walks. Obviously, there was all sorts went in the press, and then we've just come out with basically, for the individual perspective, it is just the national insurance contributions that is a considerable tax cut or change, and that's just a tinkering of rates really, rather than anything else. Although Class 2 getting abolished is a slightly different matter, but not a significant amount really to most businesses, self-employed businesses. I think, you know, the national insurance saving that arises in the basic rate band, because above that you pay the normal rate of the lower 2% rate of national insurance, whether you're an employee or self-employed individual. So individuals that are earning more than 50,270 in the UK, slightly lower figure in Scotland for the Scottish income tax rate, they're paying the same rate of tax. It's presumably going to be frozen tax bans and allowances as was forecast. And for them, it's probably all about thinking about, okay, if you're an employee, probably the only option is to go look at your pension contributions, tax relief. You know, you can get significant tax relief, and then hopefully you are saving for your retirement. But then again, the pension, the accessible age of pensions, private pensions, is going up to 57 in 5 years' time. So that might not be desirable for some people. You know, if you put money into ISAs and ISAs are increased flexibility, that could be good maybe for savings, and you can now shop around for the best rates and switch between ISAs. But it's not a particularly big thing. You know, the ISA allowance hasn't gone up for a number of years now, and there was no announcement that would go up. It's going to be the same next year. So, yeah, I think there's not a lot for individuals to be doing here.
One thing you won't be able to do, whether that's good or bad, is for other people just to put your money into a British ISA, which didn't see the light of day in the end. I'll leave our listeners to decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Ian, what's your overall takeaway? Do you agree with Matt that it's sort of a lot of talk and not a lot of
work? Yeah, it felt to me very much like a dusting down of the election engine and giving it a little bit of a polish to grab some headlines to perhaps tomorrow morning when people are looking at the newspapers, if you're not of a particular political mind, to understand the details below, you're going to look at the headlines and think, that's going to help me. And it just felt like it was something that was needed, and they couldn't really bring forward any great reform because they can't afford to lose any more ground. So I always felt that it was going to be a modestly positive autumn statement without anything controversial in there. I would have liked to have heard a little bit more from the opposition side rather than just, I guess, just a little bit of political infighting in the Commons with Rachel Reeves' statement. I didn't hear anything in there that made me think, oh wow, that's someone that I want to entrust with the economy into the future. So yeah, like I say, a dusting down and a polish in getting ready for a spring assault.
Claire, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the statement itself, when he stood up there and he talked, yeah, didn't come a lot. I think there's a lot of detail to pick through, just being through some of the underlying parts of the statement for the actual publication. As you say, there's some bits in there about ISAs, there's some bits in there about protecting DB schemes, there's some more stuff in there about CDC, there's stuff about pensions investments as well, which again is something that the government is pushing but can't force. So they want to encourage pensions to be there to invest in things that are going to help growth, but they can't force them to it because trustees have to do the right thing for their members. So I think once we pick through it, there's going to be things for people like myself and Matt and Ian to be interested in, but the headlines for your average show public is probably not going to necessarily be any more than the next changes, really. Mm. And maybe they'll get a bit excited about the pensions pots because, you know, it's pensions, who wouldn't? but I think there's going to be plenty for us techies to talk about, but it's going to be down to the detail rather than anything that's going to be mind-blowing and change the world.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you to Matty and Claire, and thank you for listening. And tune in again next week for the next edition of the FT Advisor podcast. Thank you.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.